Listening test. Task 1. You are going to listen to an interview with Paul Bernal, an expert on internet privacy rights. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for each question, 1 to 7. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Well, as the Facebook data farming scandal continues, many people are wondering, how can we just protect our data on these social media platforms? Well, governments are talking about improving data protection laws, and the European Parliament is demanding a personal explanation from Mark Zuckerberg himself. But what should we, you and I, be demanding from our policymakers and our lawmakers? Joanna Bostock asked Paul Bernal, the author of a book on internet privacy rights.
We should be expecting a lot, but I'm afraid we're likely to be disappointed by almost all of them. Politicians don't actually understand the technology enough or the implications, or they see the benefit of the technology themselves and want to use it. And there are certainly people who will be thinking, what Cambridge Analytica did is really interesting, terrible that they did it, but let's see if we can do a bit like that. Because almost all parties are trying to find new ways to use data and new ways to gather data. It would be nice to think the politicians will say, hang on, we should be dealing with this. But the problem is that actually most of the ways that they think of will actually make things worse. And there's a big danger here that the reaction is going to be, we've got to regulate it much tighter and effectively get a clampdown on freedom of speech. The key here, in the end, is going to be down to us. We need to change our behavior. If Facebook loses its user base, that's the only way that Facebook's likely to actually change.
So those of us who are the fodder also have the power to put a stop to it.
We do have the power. I don't think we have the will. Mostly people love the convenience. They love the things they can do. With the Cambridge Analytica story, a lot of the data was gathered through a little personality quiz profile thing that you just answer a few questions about yourself. Social media is awash with these things. What breed of dog are you most like? Answer these questions and find out. And actually, this is a matter of giving data to be profiled. We like that kind of stuff.
So it's actually it's a trap, in a sense, because it's dressed up as one thing, but it's actually another.
It is exactly that.
Do all these things also apply to other social media, or is there something very specific about Facebook that makes it different?
I would say that the issues apply to almost every platform, and they also apply to other internet-related companies. They apply to Google, they apply even to Apple and to Amazon in slightly different ways. The big things with Facebook are, firstly, its size. It's much bigger in terms of the user base than any of the others. And secondly, the wide variety of different things that it has, which actually gives it more scope for both profiling and for ways of manipulating people. Others are more focused and more small. Facebook tries to do pretty much everything for everybody. Yes, it applies to all of them. Facebook the most at the moment. But there isn't really a simple way that we can escape to other social networks without having the same problems arise.
That was Dr. Paul Bernal from the University of East Anglia in the UK. And the title of his book is called Internet Privacy Rights, Rights to Protect Autonomy. Well, as the Facebook data farming scandal continues, many people are wondering, how can we just protect our data on these social media platforms? Well, governments are talking about improving data protection laws, and the European Parliament is demanding a personal explanation from Mark Zuckerberg himself. But what should we, you and I, be demanding from our policymakers and our lawmakers? Well, Joanna Bostock asked Paul Bernal, the author of a book on internet privacy rights.
We should be expecting a lot, but I'm afraid we're likely to be disappointed by almost all of them. Politicians don't actually understand the technology enough or the implications, or they see the benefit of the technology themselves and want to use it. And there are certainly people who will be thinking, what Cambridge Analytica did is really interesting, terrible that they did it, but let's see if we can do a bit like that. Because almost all parties are trying to find new ways to use data and new ways to gather data. It would be nice to think the politicians will say, hang on, we should be dealing with this. But the problem is that actually most of the ways that they think of will actually make things worse. And there's a big danger here that the reaction is going to be, we've got to regulate it much tighter and effectively get a clampdown on freedom of speech. The key here, in the end, is going to be down to us. We need to change our behavior. If Facebook loses its user base, that's the only way that Facebook's likely to actually change.
So those of us who are the fodder also have the power to put a stop to it.
We do have the power. I don't think we have the will. Mostly people love the convenience. They love the things they can do. With the Cambridge Analytica story, a lot of the data was gathered through a little personality quiz profile thing that you just answer a few questions about yourself. Social media is awash with these things. What breed of dog are you most like? Answer these questions and find out. And actually, this is a matter of giving data to be profiled. We like that kind of stuff.
So it's actually it's a trap, in a sense, because it's dressed up as one thing, but it's actually another.
It is exactly that.
Do all these things also apply to other social media, or is there something very specific about Facebook that makes it different?
I would say that the issues apply to almost every platform, and they also apply to other internet-related companies. They apply to Google, they apply even to Apple and to Amazon in slightly different ways. The big things with Facebook are, firstly, its size. It's much bigger in terms of the user base than any of the others. And secondly, the wide variety of different things that it has, which actually gives it more scope for both profiling and for ways of manipulating people. Others are more focused and more small. Facebook tries to do pretty much everything for everybody. Yes, it applies to all of them. Facebook the most at the moment. But there isn't really a simple way that we can escape to other social networks without having the same problems arise.
That was Dr. Paul Bernal from the University of East Anglia in the UK. And the title of his book is called Internet Privacy Rights, Rights to Protect Autonomy.
Task 2. You are going to listen to an interview with two Australian experts after the 2020 bushfires about effective charity donations. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for each question 1 to 8. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
So you have to know enough to be able to give the donated dollar away well so that it makes a difference. In this situation as well, we're not talking about one cyclone hit community. We're talking about massive across Australia issues in tiny communities, hard to access communities. We're talking about businesses. We're talking about individuals. We're talking about community facilities. So you can't sit in Sydney or Melbourne and write a check and make that all go away. You have to be on the ground, often 24/7, talking with people. You also have to be there for the long term, because a lot of those needs are not going to emerge until later, because people are still running on adrenaline. But things like, you know, 1983, the Ash Wednesday bushfires, for those of the listeners who remember that situation, people are still suffering post-traumatic stress disorder. People are still needing help. And this is the same from the Black Friday bushfires, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we know that the charity dollar is the long-term dollar. The government dollar comes in and does the immediate, enabling of people to actually have enough food, enough water, because they're set up to be able to do that. They have systems to do that. But for the charity dollar, it's got to be there to work with communities when they can decide what they want to rebuild, how and when they've got the capacity to actually think about that.
And Wendy, there's a couple of points you made that I want to pick up on with Jess Bowman. You talked about charities needing to tell the story of what they do. So presumably they're going to need a marketing budget for that. Mm-hmm. And also the costs and resources involved in getting into those communities and staying in those communities. And Jess, we so often see assessments of what percentage of the donations are spent on admin costs, and that's often taken to be an indication of the quality of their work or the effectiveness of our giving. How good an indicator is a low percentage of money spent on admin costs, that our money's going where we want it to?
It's a terrible indicator. It's the worst possible indicator. I think sort of a good benchmark between 10 and 20% is reasonable for administration overheads. Any less than that, and there's a real worry that the money won't be spent. I've seen it time and time and time and again. Charities that advertise and promote the fact that they don't spend any money on administration are incapable of actually getting the money out the door. It takes people with skills, it takes governance systems, it takes financial systems to actually be able to spend money effectively. If you see administration costs that are very high, so sort of upwards of 30%, that's a red flag. But then it's worth investigating that further. So looking at how the quality of their actual outcomes. So if you think about it, if you're going to go to a fancy restaurant, for example, you'd expect that they spend a lot on the chef, and the quality of the product is a lot higher because of that. And you can think of charities the same way. If you go to if a charity is spending a lot of money on their executive and management team, then you can have an expectation that there are really high quality outcomes that come from the organisation. The challenge for a lot of people, though, is actually looking at the outcomes. So what is the charity actually delivering? And the only real way for an outsider to understand that is by looking at their annual report, and some charities will publish also an impact report. And that will give you an indication of what they're actually producing. And that's really where the conversation should sit. So what is the charity actually setting out? What are they saying that they're going to achieve? And then how are they reporting against those milestones?
Do you have a sense of how many charities are getting it right in Australia? How many are doing well?
In terms of setting a very clear strategy, setting goals for that strategy, and then reporting against those strategy, I haven't seen a huge amount. So the ones that are listed on our website, they all do this to varying extents of quality, but that probably makes up about 15% of large charities in terms of all charities.
So you have to know enough to be able to give the donated dollar away well so that it makes a difference. In this situation as well, we're not talking about one cyclone hit community. We're talking about massive across Australia issues in tiny communities, hard to access communities. We're talking about businesses. We're talking about individuals. We're talking about community facilities. So you can't sit in Sydney or Melbourne and write a check and make that all go away. You have to be on the ground, often 24/7, talking with people. You also have to be there for the long term, because a lot of those needs are not going to emerge until later, because people are still running on adrenaline. But things like, you know, 1983, the Ash Wednesday bushfires, for those of the listeners who remember that situation, people are still suffering post-traumatic stress disorder. People are still needing help. And this is the same from the Black Friday bushfires, etc., etc. So, you know, we know that the charity dollar is the long-term dollar. The government dollar comes in and does the immediate, enabling of people to actually have enough food, enough water, because they're set up to be able to do that. They have systems to do that. But for the charity dollar, it's got to be there to work with communities when they can decide what they want to rebuild, how and when they've got the capacity to actually think about that.
And Wendy, there's a couple of points you made that I want to pick up on with Jess Bowman. You talked about charities needing to tell the story of what they do. So presumably they're going to need a marketing budget for that. Mm-hmm. And also the costs and resources involved in getting into those communities and staying in those communities. And Jess, we so often see assessments of what percentage of the donations are spent on admin costs, and that's often taken to be an indication of the quality of their work or the effectiveness of our giving. How good an indicator is a low percentage of money spent on admin costs that our money's going where we want it to?
It's a terrible indicator. It's the worst possible indicator. I think sort of a good benchmark between 10 and 20% is reasonable for administration overheads. Any less than that, and there's a real worry that the money won't be spent. I've seen it time and time and time and again. Charities that advertise and promote the fact that they don't spend any money on administration are incapable of actually getting the money out the door. It takes people. It takes people with skills. It takes governance systems. It takes financial systems to actually be able to spend money effectively. If you see administration costs that are very high, so sort of upwards of 30%, that's a red flag. But then it's worth investigating that further. So looking at how the quality of their actual outcomes. So if you think about it, if you're going to go to a fancy restaurant, for example, you'd expect that they spend a lot on the chef, and the quality of the product is a lot higher because of that. And you can think of charities the same way. If you go to If a charity is spending a lot of money on their executive and management team, then you can have an expectation that there are really high quality outcomes that come from the organisation. The challenge for a lot of people, though, is actually looking at the outcomes. So what is the charity actually delivering? And the only real way for an outsider to understand that is by looking at their annual report, and some charities will publish also an impact report. And that will give you an indication of what they're actually producing. And that's really where the conversation should sit. So what is the charity actually setting out? What are they saying that they're going to achieve? And then how are they reporting against those milestones?
Do you have a sense of how many charities are getting it right in Australia? How many are doing well?
In terms of setting a very clear strategy, setting goals for that strategy, and then reporting against those strategy, I haven't seen a huge amount. So the ones that are listed on our website, they all do this to varying extents of quality, but that probably makes up about 15% of large charities in terms of all charities.
Task 3. You are going to listen to a report about a project called WeCyclers. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, complete the sentences 1 to 7 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
First, though, we've got Amelia Martin-Hempel, who's just back from Lagos, Nigeria. So, Amelia, rubbish is a pretty big problem around the world, and in Nigeria's largest city, it's a hard one to get away from.
It is. Lagos is thought to be home to over 21 million people, and it's expanded so fast in the last decade that the city's waste management has become a bit of a logistical nightmare. Much of the rubbish isn't collected at all, so it just gets dumped, burned, or buried. And the waste that is collected mostly ends up in one of several massive landfill sites that are already overflowing. Because the city's grown so quickly, some of the biggest dumps are now surrounded by homes and businesses and pose a major health and safety hazard.
Okay, that does not sound good. And how much rubbish are we talking about?
Well, the official figure is that Lagos State generates about 13,000 metric tons of waste per day, but other estimates are much larger. I mean, to visualise that, one metric ton is about the weight of a small elephant. So, I mean, that's a huge volume of rubbish.
Right, and how is the city currently dealing with those 13,000 small, dirty elephants every day? Does the government come and pick up people's waste?
Well, about 60% of the population in Lagos live in informal settlements or slums, which makes waste management even harder. But rubbish collection is not a free service. Households and businesses have to pay for it, and most of it is done by private contractors. So that doesn't help the issue. The state government has launched a Cleaner Lagos initiative to try and crack down on people just dumping their litter. Because when the rainy season comes, this waste build-up causes flooding and disease outbreaks. And as you can imagine, it's the people living on reclaimed land or slum housing who suffer the most from this.
So at the start of the show, we heard from an entrepreneur you met in Lagos who's been trying to change things.
Yes. Her name is Bilikis Abiola, and she's the founder of WeCyclers. It's a community recycling initiative that rewards people in low-income areas for recycling. They're trying to clean up the city and reduce the amount of waste that ends up in landfill. It started off as a simple operation back in 2012, when Bilikis moved back to Nigeria after studying in the US.
And then we actually had to just walk around communities one by one, knock on doors and tell people that, hey, can you just keep your trash for us and we'll come back in a week's time and collect your trash.
And now it's expanded.
We have a fleet of low-cost cargo bicycles and tricycles that go around people's houses and collect their recyclable waste in exchange for points which are sent to them via SMS. The points can then be exchanged for household items and even cash. And then the waste that is collected is aggregated and sold to recyclers who can turn them into new products.
Okay, so the residents collect all their recyclable stuff and hand it over to the people on bikes, and they earn points for doing that in return.
Right, trash into cash, or gifts actually. And the guys on the bikes, they get paid by the weight they've collected when they take the material to the sorting hub.
Right, so it's a sort of recycling chain and everyone gets a cut.
Exactly, and the key point in the chain is these bicycles and motorised three-wheeler tricycles. They're known as the WeCycles, and they're specially designed to navigate the narrow streets of the slums. I went to go and meet one of the WeCycle trash collectors, Julius, who was just setting out on his round. He's been working for the company for about 2 years.
First, though, we've got Amelia Martin-Hemphill, who's just back from Lagos, Nigeria. So, Amelia, rubbish is a pretty big problem around the world, and in Nigeria's largest city, it's a hard one to get away from.
It is. Lagos is thought to be home to over 21 million people, and it's expanded so fast in the last decade that the city's waste management has become a bit of a logistical nightmare. Much of the rubbish isn't collected at all, so it just gets dumped, burned, or buried. And the waste that is collected mostly ends up in one of several massive landfill sites that are already overflowing. Because the city's grown so quickly, some of the biggest dumps are now surrounded by homes and businesses and pose a major health and safety hazard.
OK, that does not sound good. And how much rubbish are we talking about?
Well, the official figure is that Lagos State generates about 13,000 metric tons of waste per day, but other estimates are much larger. I mean, to visualise that, one metric ton is about the weight of a small elephant. So, I mean, that's a huge volume of rubbish.
Right, and how is the city currently dealing with those 13,000 small, dirty elephants every day? Does the government come and pick up people's waste?
Well, about 60% of the population in Lagos live in informal settlements or slums, which makes waste management even harder. But rubbish collection is not a free service. Households and businesses have to pay for it, and most of it is done by private contractors, so that doesn't help the issue. The state government has launched a Cleaner Lagos initiative to try and crack down on people just dumping their litter. Because when the rainy season comes, this waste build-up causes flooding and disease outbreaks. And as you can imagine, it's the people living on reclaimed land or slum housing who suffer the most from this.
So at the start of the show, we heard from an entrepreneur you met in Lagos who's been trying to change things.
Yes. Her name is Bilikis Abiola, and she's the founder of WeCyclers. It's a community recycling initiative that rewards people in low-income areas for recycling. They're trying to clean up the city and reduce the amount of waste that ends up in landfill. It started off as a simple operation back in 2012, when Bilikis moved back to Nigeria after studying in the US.
And then we actually had to just walk around communities one by one, knock on doors and tell people that, hey, can you just keep your trash for us and we'll come back in a week's time and collect your trash.
And now it's expanded.
We have a fleet of low-cost cargo bicycles and tricycles that go around people's houses and collect their recyclable waste in exchange for points which are sent to them via SMS. The points can then be exchanged for household items and even cash. And then the waste that is collected is aggregated and sold to recyclers who can turn them into new products.
OK, so the residents collect all their recyclable stuff and hand it over to the people on bikes, and they earn points for doing that in return.
Right. Trash into cash, or gifts, actually. And the guys on the bikes, they get paid by the weight they've collected when they take the material to the sorting hub.
Right, so it's a sort of recycling chain and everyone gets a cut.
Exactly. And the key point in the chain is these bicycles and motorised three-wheeler tricycles. They're known as the WeCycles, and they're specially designed to navigate the narrow streets of the slums. I went to go and meet one of the WeCycle trash collectors, Julius, who was just setting out on his round. He's been working for the company for about 2 years.
Task 4. You are going to listen to a talk about the importance of libraries throughout the centuries. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences 1 to 7 with the sentence endings A to J. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
All over the country, all sorts of encounters are taking place in libraries, in organised groups, but also completely randomly. When I was little, you had to be quiet in the library. Not anymore. The oldest free-lending library in Scotland at Inner Peffery in Perthshire was started in 1680 by the local laird, who believed that books and the knowledge they contained should be freely available to everyone. He also established a school so local children could become literate and make the most of the library. People walked for miles to come and borrow books to widen their horizons and transform their ways of looking at the world. In the 19th century, a network of working men's libraries sprang up, offering access to books and newspapers, opening their members' eyes to the political systems they lived under. They were a space for debate, for visiting speakers, and for fueling a deeper understanding of the world. These libraries were often the incubators for the political movements that transformed people's rights and working conditions. They were a safe space for ideas and for the vigorous discussion of opposing points of view. Even robber barons like the steel magnate Andrew Carnegie understood the value of libraries. He said his aim was to support the industrious and ambitious, not those who need everything done for them, but those who, being most anxious and able to help themselves, deserve and will be benefited by help from others. His foundation endowed more than 2,500 libraries, many of them in his native Scotland. In the southern states of America, where strict segregation meant those institutions were for white people only, he set up separate libraries for the black population. A library card is a powerful weapon to change lives. With it, we can learn about other places, other ways of seeing the world, other lives. We learn how to value what we have, to mourn what we've lost, and to dream of what we might become. But just when we need it most, these are dark days for libraries, seen as a soft target for hard-pressed local authorities in a time of austerity. We're told that libraries are an unnecessary luxury. Books are readily available through electronic sources, some of them illegal pirates who exploit the work of writers without paying for it. And if you want a physical book, it's easy to find deep discounts in supermarkets and online retailers such as Amazon. But even at those knockdown prices, not everyone can afford to buy books. Not everyone has a safe place to read. What's almost as bad as the way those of us who do buy books are corralled into a limited vision of the world? When we go into a bookshop or a library, we genuinely browse. We pick up books whose covers intrigue us, often placed in our path by a bookseller who loved the book and thinks more people should read it. We read the cover blurbs, the opening pages. And more often than not, we walk out with books we'd never have thought of buying when we walked in the door. But those bargain retailers short-circuit the browsing process. They make it easy for us. They offer us titles to tempt us. Their complex algorithms are designed to draw us to what we already like, rather than throwing something in our path that challenges us and even makes us uncomfortable. Libraries are still places where we stumble over surprises, where serendipity puts a book in our way that intrigues us and makes us explore further. But modern public libraries are so much more than that. They have become our agoras. People come there for advice, for training and studying, for all kinds of support, for companionship, for conversation, for book groups, local history societies, jigsaw puzzle clubs, board game afternoons, mother and toddler groups that breed the next generation of people who read and think. There's also powerful evidence that libraries create economic benefits. A literate workforce is a more productive one. All over the country, all sorts of encounters are taking place in libraries, in organised groups, but also completely randomly. When I was little, you had to be quiet in the library. Not anymore. The oldest free-lending library in Scotland at Inner Peffery in Perthshire was started in 1680 by the local laird, who believed that books and the knowledge they contained should be freely available to everyone. He also established a school so local children could become literate and make the most of the library. People walked for miles to come and borrow books to widen their horizons and transform their ways of looking at the world. In the 19th century, a network of working men's libraries sprang up, offering access to books and newspapers, opening their members' eyes to the political systems they lived under. They were a space for debate, for visiting speakers, and for fueling a deeper understanding of the world. These libraries were often the incubators for the political movements that transformed people's rights and working conditions. They were a safe space for ideas and for the vigorous discussion of opposing points of view. Even robber barons like the steel magnate Andrew Carnegie understood the value of libraries. He said his aim was to support the industrious and ambitious, not those who need everything done for them, but those who, being most anxious and able to help themselves, deserve and will be benefited by help from others. His foundation endowed more than 2,500 libraries, many of them in his native Scotland. In the southern states of America, where strict segregation meant those institutions were for white people only, he set up separate libraries for the black population. A library card is a powerful weapon to change lives. With it, we can learn about other places, other ways of seeing the world, other lives. We learn how to value what we have, to mourn what we've lost, and to dream of what we might become. But just when we need it most, these are dark days for libraries, seen as a soft target for hard-pressed local authorities in a time of austerity. We're told that libraries are an unnecessary luxury. Books are readily available through electronic sources, some of them illegal pirates who exploit the work of writers without paying for it. And if you want a physical book, it's easy to find deep discounts in supermarkets and online retailers such as Amazon. But even at those knockdown prices, not everyone can afford to buy books. Not everyone has a safe place to read. What's almost as bad is the way those of us who do buy books are corralled into a limited vision of the world. When we go into a bookshop or a library, we genuinely browse. We pick up books whose covers intrigue us, often placed in our path by a bookseller who loved the book and thinks more people should read it. We read the cover blurbs, the opening pages. And more often than not, we walk out with books we'd never have thought of buying when we walked in the door. But those bargain retailers short-circuit the browsing process. They make it easy for us. They offer us titles to tempt us. Their complex algorithms are designed to draw us to what we already like, rather than throwing something in our path that challenges us and even makes us uncomfortable. Libraries are still places where we stumble over surprises, where serendipity puts a book in our way that intrigues us and makes us explore further. But modern public libraries are so much more than that. They have become our agoras. People come there for advice, for training and studying, for all kinds of support, for companionship, for conversation, for book groups, local history societies, jigsaw puzzle clubs, board game afternoons, mother and toddler groups that breed the next generation of people who read and think. There's also powerful evidence that libraries create economic benefits. A literate workforce is a more productive one.
This is the end of the listening test.